Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me, Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knowles Network, your source for the best information in natural living on all aspects. And thank you for joining us today. You can always join us either online. We have many classes that are CE Broker certified for professionals such as nurses, midwives, massage therapists, acupuncturists, RDs, nutritionists. And if you are not a professional, you can also take our classes both on ground and online. And then rather than getting CE credits, you get a certificate of completion of whatever class that you take with us. And that can be used towards your career in natural health, if you so want to do that, or just for yourself and your family for your own self-care knowledge. So we have classes going on just about every single day. In fact, today we have a very high-level class on botanical pharmacognosy, particularly for reducing histamine. As you may know, histamine, of course, is related to all kinds of allergies, and that class is actually free and being sponsored by Gaia Herbs. So you can just go to naturalnurse.com under calendar, scroll down, and if you listen to this show on a different day, you still can get these classes because they're all on the archive. So if you miss something and you want to do it, you can let us know and we'll point you to the right archive link. We also have on-ground classes. They're going on in Florida right now. And every week we gather with a group and we learn about what plants and plants growing right outside the door you can use for food and medicine. And we have a full-day workshop at Hippocrates Institute in Florida where we will be going out and gathering the edible and medicinal plants and making them into medicine that you get to take home, such as salves and tinctures, and learn how to use them correctly for your health issues. So much is going on. Visit the website, naturalnurse.com. Take a look at our books. We have 12 that myself and Dr. Zamperone have written, as well as the radio shows and online and on-ground classes. So we're so happy that you join us. Many of you join us. So we have quite a large listening audience. We're so happy to see all the click-throughs from hundreds of thousands of you to our podcast. And today we are so happy to have as our guest Dr. Jason Fung. Dr. Fung earned his medical degree at the University of Toronto, where he also completed his internal medicine residency before heading to the University of California in Los Angeles for his fellowship and specialty in nephrology. He currently practices as a kidney specialist in Toronto, and in fact, he is the chief of the Department of Medicine at Scarborough General Hospital. In addition to clinical medicine, he is also on the board of directors of Low Carb Diabetes Association and the scientific editor of the Journal of Insulin Resistance. During the course of treating thousands of patients, it became clear to Dr. Fung that the epidemic of type 2 diabetes and obesity was getting worse. The prevailing dietary recommendations to reduce dietary fat and calories were clearly ineffective. So he founded the Intensive Dietary Management Program to provide a unique treatment focus for type 2 diabetes and obesity rather than focusing on medications. His clinic focuses on dietary changes that are simple yet effective. He wanted to share this information with the world, so he wrote his book, Obesity Code, which we'll be talking about today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, which explores the underlying hormonal balance that leads to obesity and recommends specific effective strategies that address the root cause of weight gain and other metabolic issues. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Fung. Hello, are you there?
Hello?
Yep, you're there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you got to talk a little bit louder.
Oh, I just heard you right now. It's okay.
Okay,
that's
very
fine.
Good. We're good. So
okay.
Perfect. We hear you loud and clear, and thank you so much for joining us. I know you're coming to us from Canada.
Right.
So you sound like you're around the corner. I'm in Florida. I'm in what I would call a better place, unless you really, you know, love snow and cold for right now. And Canada's also beautiful for me in the summer. I was recently
in Vancouver. Yeah.
Because I was doing a consultation with an herb company there, and
oh,
it's
cool.
Really, really a beautiful place. Now, it looks like you have spent a lot of your professional career looking into obesity and the fact that it seems to be on the increase along with other metabolic issues.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the what people get sick with these days, it's far less likely to be these sort of things that, like infections and so on, tuberculosis and so on that we had before. And now what we're seeing now is everything to do with obesity, type 2 diabetes, and the metabolic syndrome, which includes kidney disease, liver disease, heart disease, strokes, cancer. All of those things are really the major killers today of of Americans and Canadians. So really that's the issue, and that's what we have to deal with. And unfortunately, obesity and both obesity and type 2 diabetes are on the rise. And sometimes people try and say, oh, it's a genetic thing, but it's not, because we see very clearly that it's something that has gone up since the late 1970s, 1980s, 1990s. So it's really only a 25, 30-year phenomenon. So you can't really blame it on our genetic makeup, because our genes haven't changed. It's within the span of a single generation that all these problems have happened. But therein lies the opportunity, so that if we have a treatment for this, then we can bring it back down. So that's really what I've been looking at.
And that is really true, that epidemiologically we can look back in time and actually graph what kind of cultural and environmental changes occurred along with this spike.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the thing that sometimes is missing, because people sometimes get this idea that, oh, it's inevitable, or it's due to our genes, but it's not. It's got to be something else. And what we have to do is really look at the changes that have happened in our diet predominantly and say, well, could it be those things that are responsible? And that's really the major change, is the dietary change. And of course, that makes sense when you're talking about obesity and type 2 diabetes, that diet would be the major issue. Because once again, we talk about giving medications and medications and medications, but obviously that's not the answer, because more than anything else, it's a dietary disease. And this fact gets lost on most doctors and researchers, because they're all looking at, oh, what happens to the pancreas and this and that. But it's like, let's get to the bottom line. We know that if you have a type 2 diabetic and they lose weight, that type 2 diabetes very often goes away. So obviously it's a reversible disease. Yet we have people like the American Diabetes Association saying, oh, it's a chronic and progressive disease. Don't worry if you're going on insulin. I'm saying, well, you should worry if you're going on insulin, because it's getting worse. Why would you want to have a reversible disease and make it get worse, right? You can't accept that. That's unacceptable from a health standpoint. But it's a dietary issue, so you need to fix the diet. And what we've done is we've tried to use drugs to fix a dietary issue. And it's nowhere is it worse than in the physicians, because the way we get taught is that, oh, here, you have a disease, let me give you a pill, right? And that worked really well in the 19th century when you had things such as pneumonia, for example, or tuberculosis, infections. So we have this model of disease where somebody comes to us, they get sick, we give you a pill, you get better. Great, that works well with antibiotics, for example. But it doesn't work when you're trying to treat metabolic and dietary diseases, because obviously if you have,
That's okay. You can shut your
obviously,
phone off. Doctor, thank you.
Obviously, if you have metabolic diseases, then you have to treat the diet. You can't use drugs to treat a dietary disease, because that isn't going to work. And guess what? It doesn't. And when it doesn't work, we pretend that, oh, well, you know, that's just the way the disease is. And it's like, it's not. It's because you focused on the wrong thing. And that's the one thing that I realized with obesity, too, is that we've kind of focused entirely on the wrong issue. Because what we've done is we've pretended that this is all calories. We have what I sometimes call in nutrition science, where they have physics envy, which is that they want to be like physics, where you have a hard science and, you know, you can be like Einstein and, you know, quantum mechanics and all this kind of stuff. And you want to have it like a hard science. So what we've done is we've taken a concept, which is calories, and tried to apply it to the body. But you know what? The body just doesn't care at all about calories. It has no way to measure calories. It has no idea how many calories you're taking in. How many calories you take in has very little relevance as to the calories that you expend. So most of the expenditure is to keep your body running, your heart, your liver, your brain, and it has no measure of calories, right? So if your body doesn't have any, can't recognize it, can't identify it, can't respond to it, why would we worry about it, right? That's the whole idea. And, you know, you get this kind of idea that it's all about calories. So then you could say, for example, and people do, that you could eat a plate of brownies for dinner, or you could eat a kale salad with grilled salmon and olive oil. And if they're the same calories, they will be equally fattening. And it's like, okay, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
It is so, it's so really against the complexity of the body as well as mainstream scientific thought. When
absolutely.
We look at actual studies about how the body metabolizes different foods.
Absolutely. As soon as that food goes into your mouth, your body will respond completely differently to the brownies than to the kale salad. Okay, and we know that. We know that very well because obviously, if you eat the brownies, different things happen. Insulin goes up, your blood sugars go up. When you eat the salad, it doesn't, right? So there's a huge difference between the two foods, even though they're the same calories. And your body will respond to those hormones completely differently, as in one will make you fat and one will make you thin, right? And it's so obvious because it's so common sense, yet we have doctors, for example, and nutritionists and, you know, real nutrition, like real authorities out there saying, oh, it's about the calories, about the calories, about the calories. Like, why would you push a completely outdated model?
Well, we do know why. You know, I mean, do you think you are an MD, you are highly educated, and your training did not even include what you're sharing with us and what you talk about in depth? And I really suggest everyone get a copy of your book, Unlocking the Secrets of Weight Loss, because this is not just a little new age mumbo jumbo. This is Dr. Jason Fung, medical doctor, highly trained, evaluating the science, but bringing it to you in a language that you can understand. So I really have to applaud your efforts here. But I believe, I don't know, you know, if it's conspiratorial or the only one who really wins by teaching doctors the concept of pharmaceutical-based therapies when that is the incorrect approach and has been disproven in science is the pharmaceutical industry. The patients don't get well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, I agree with you. And that was, part of why I wrote the book, you know, The Obesity Code, was that there's a lot of people who are interested in keeping this kind of message out there. The pharmaceuticals want to sell drugs, and I can't blame them for that, right? But it doesn't mean that we can go along with it and teach people that it's okay to prescribe drugs and not worry about the diet, for example. But even from a dietary side of things, there's a lot of people who really want you to believe in this calorie theory, and they've spent a lot of money advertising. And it's not advertising to the public necessarily. It's advertising to dietitians, to researchers, and so on. So, for example, the sugar companies and the food companies love this whole calorie concept because nobody sells a product called calories, right? Nobody has a brand called calories. So you can blame calories for everything. And that's exactly what they did. So, for example, Coca-Cola loves this calorie concept because what it can say is that, well, you know, you think that you shouldn't drink this sugary soda because it makes you fat, but you know what? Hey, a couple of helpings of broccoli will make you just as fat. And again, that's purely ridiculous, and everybody knows that instinctively. But now you get some researchers, and they've done this. They've paid millions and millions of dollars for people to write articles, you know, to other doctors, for example. Recently, there is a couple of doctors that wrote a article in the medical journal, a very highly influential journal, about why sugar really isn't bad. It's not any worse than any other calorie, for example. Then when you read his conflicts of interest, oh, guess what? His hospital takes a lot of money from the sugar industry, from the beverage industry. He himself has been funded, and they've sent them on trips all over the world to talk about why sugar is not so bad. Also, you have these doctors who basically are taking money to tell other doctors that, hey, sugar is not worse than any other calories. Unfortunately, they work at the University of Toronto where I am.
Yes, and see, this is the diabolical part. But you, from my point of view, I would say you are a young person. And it's very exciting because here you are, totally medically trained, the head of a medical department, and yet working from a scientific viewpoint as well as a clinical viewpoint because you have seen it help patients, and most likely you went into medicine because you wanted to help patients. And you're
Absolutely.
Seeing not only does this help patients, it is scientifically valid. So I will task you with the job, especially as we move forward into the future, making your work, because of its scientific validity, standard of practice. That's what we have to work towards. And it's worrisome on so many levels, like you're saying, from the point of view of policymakers, and we'll just look at the United States. They're about to put in a big high level of policymaking a person who owns a junk food chain, which is Hardee's and Carl's Jr., some of the absolutely worst food you can find anywhere. I don't know if you have it in Canada. I mean, it's the pits. And here he is going to be in charge of food-making policy.
Yeah, and obviously he's going to be very partial to fast food, which is highly processed, and a lot of these foods kind of contain a lot of highly refined carbohydrates, refined grains, a lot of sugar, and that's just going to make people obese. And the way to fight against it really is to educate yourself, right? To understand that some of the stuff that people tell you, even if it comes from, sort of high up authorities, may or may not make sense. And you really got to see for yourself what works, because the thing is that our policies to date are not working, right? Because we have the proof. The proof is that obesity has been rising as a problem. It's not getting better, it's getting worse. So we have all these people who tell you, for many years, cut your calories. We have calorie labels. We have apps that track calories. We've told everybody since they're like in grade 2 to count calories, energy balance. But the whole concept is completely unphysiologic. It doesn't agree with how the body works. And it's been a complete failure. And that's not my opinion, right? That's the truth because of this obesity epidemic. If it worked, we wouldn't have an obesity epidemic, right? It's not. And this is where I think things are very, very unfair because
And
the
wait,
thing
nor
is,
did we. We don't have to go too far back in time. And people were eating lots of fat, by the way, right? They were raising
absolutely.
Their own animals and killing them and eating lots of milk and cheese. And there was no obesity epidemic.
Right. And this is the thing. You can just go back to the 50s and 60s. So there's two main issues, I think, that are important. The two big changes in dietary policy, as well as the way we eat. So one is what we eat, right? So in 1977, we told people to eat a low-fat diet. I don't think it was malicious. I think that was just what people believed at the time, but it was wrong. And it looks like, you know, we're kind of paying the price for that. But a lot of us have kind of recognized the truth of that, right? So nowadays, people have gone back to eating more fat, avocados and olive oil and nuts. So the Mediterranean diet, which most people acknowledge as a quite a healthy diet, is not a low-fat diet. It's a high-fat diet, right? So people have been bringing that back. The other, and people are understanding that sugar is quite bad for us, so people are talking about sugar taxes, and also refined grains, so people are going to more whole grains and low-carb diets, and that's obviously very popular. But I think that's only half the issue, and I'm probably one of the few people that are really talking about this a lot, is that a lot of people have made those changes and still are not losing weight because you've really only attacked half the problem, which is what you eat. And for the most part, we kind of agree on that. Nobody says white bread's good for you, right? But the other issue is when to eat. And this is the other major dietary change since the 1970s, which has gone largely unrecognized. If you look back at the NHANES survey, which is a large American survey of how people eat and what they eat, and look at the number of times people eat. In 1977, it was 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner. In 2005, it was closer to 6 times a day, right? So you've got breakfast, lunch, you know, breakfast, snack, lunch, snack, dinner, snack, right? So basically what you're doing is eating constantly from the minute that you get up to the minute you go to bed. And the thing is that the body, the way it works, is that you can really only be sort of in one of two states. You're either storing food energy or you're burning it. Okay, so when you eat, insulin goes up and it tells your body to store energy. And that's good because you store it from breakfast to dinner. But when you sleep, you're not eating. And if you weren't, if you needed to eat all the time, you'd just die in your sleep. So, of course, during that time, we actually pull the energy back out. So during the day, you eat, you store energy. During the night, you fast, which is not eating, and you burn that stored energy or you digest it, right? So now what you can see is that the body either is storing energy or burning energy. It can't do both at the same time, so it has to be one or the other. Now all of a sudden, if you store energy from the minute you get up to the minute you go to bed, you can see you just don't have any time to burn that energy that you've taken in. So that's the other major change, is the when to eat question. So it's a question of what to eat, and we've eaten a lot more low-fat, kind of high-carbohydrate foods, which is more fattening. And then we've also gone to this idea of eating constantly. And it's pushed by so many people. Oh, you got to eat all the time. You got to eat all the time. And it's like, why? You think that eating more often is going to make you lose weight? Like, that sounds like the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Yet, when people say it over and over and over again, and you hear it on the news, and you hear it from your doctor, and you hear it from your dietitian, and you see it in the newspaper that, oh, you should eat, you know, 25 times a day, spread out through little meals.
Right.
It's like,
so
oh, okay,
that,
well.
I know, I often hear that, particularly with people who have blood sugar variations, such as hypoglycemia, that if they use a small high-protein snack between meals, they don't seem to get those highs and lows. So you're saying that that's not a good idea, or is it just not a good idea for people in general?
In general, it's not a good idea because think back again to the 1950s. People are eating 3 times a day, and nobody's having problems with their blood sugar. The only time you have a problem is with type 1 diabetes when you're using insulin, when you're injecting yourself with insulin, because in that situation, which is a very specific indication, the insulin that we inject is not the same as the insulin that we produce. That is, when your body produces insulin, but it adjusts the level kind of every nanosecond, whereas you inject it twice a day. So you have to match what you eat to your insulin, which is taken twice a day, whereas in people not taking medications, their bodies will make that adjustment. And guess what? In 99.99% of people, it will keep the blood sugar in a normal level, whether you eat once a day, 3 times a day, 10 times a day, or once a week, right? It will keep the blood sugar normal. That's because our body has that ability to do that. So unless you're in that situation where you are injecting yourself with insulin for type 1 diabetes, you don't need to worry about that. It makes no difference. Yet somehow, without any kind of studies or anything, people have gotten the notion that they should eat constantly. If you're eating constantly, you're giving your body the instruction, right, the hormonal instruction, which is the insulin, of storing energy. You're saying the minute you get up, you want to store energy. And you want to keep storing energy until you go to bed. So you have maybe 4 hours in the middle of the night where you're actually burning energy. And you have like 18, 20 hours where you're storing energy. And then you wonder, why am I getting fat? Well, it's because you're not burning your energy that you've taken in. You're not giving your time to digest it, right? So think about the way that our body is. You need to be in balance between being in the fed state where you're storing energy and the fasted state where you're burning energy. So go back to the 1950s again. People ate breakfast, lunch, dinner, no snacks, right? No bedtime snacks, nothing. So you eat for about 10 or 12 hours of the day, and you fast for about 12 to 14 hours.
So you're saying that culturally, all those snacks were not part of just the daily routine?
Absolutely
not. In most
not.
Cultures, is that how, what you're saying? Like if we look at epidemiological evidence?
Yeah. So again, you can look at epidemiologic evidence, or you can just look at, I grew up in the 70s and nobody ate mid-morning snacks. Nobody ate after school snacks. If you tried the school snack, your mom would say, no, you're going to ruin your dinner, right? There's no bedtime snacks. Now, if you go to schools, like my son, it's all, you know, he has breakfast and then he has a mid-morning snack, then he has lunch, then he has an after-school snack, then he has dinner, and then if he has soccer, he has a snack in between, right? So it's like, why do you need to eat all the time?
Well, hold that thought. That's a very interesting and reset of our, cultural norms, which is really interesting, Dr. Fung. We're going to take just a break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we are talking today with Dr. Jason Fung, MD, and we're talking about his fantastic and easy-to-read book, The Obesity Code. And we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.
Welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. And you can find out more and join us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we've written many, many books. We also have hundreds of radio shows that you can listen to right here on Progressive Radio Network, and we have other radio shows. We also have online classes where you can take a class in careers in natural health so that you can formulate your educational goals and be able to share with others and have that be your living rather than just your hobby if you are so inclined. And we have many CE broker certified classes for healthcare professionals. And anyone can take those classes and get a certification. Obviously not a license. You have to get a license if you want to be a healthcare professional, such as our guest, Dr. Jason Fung, who is a medical doctor and also practices as a kidney specialist, nephrologist, and he's the chief of the Department of Medicine at Scarsborough General Hospital, which is no easy task, and it puts him in a fantastic position. I'm so glad he is in it because he is obviously a well-researched scientist as well as somebody who has seen both clinically as well as scientifically what's important about looking at diet and its relationship to disease. And that is why he wrote his wonderful book, The Obesity Code, which I think is so well laid out. Now, welcome back to the show, Dr. Fung.
Thank you.
Now, you wrote this book for who? Did you write it for your colleagues or more for the public or both?
Both. I mean, if you look at, I've presented a lot of this material to other physicians, and most of them really had no idea.
They have no
idea.
I mean,
they understand some of the physiologic principles a lot better, but really they were all into the calories in, calories out theory, which is really so unhelpful in trying to help people lose weight. So it's written at a level which is understandable, but the concepts are still there, even if you're very advanced, that you should be able to get something out of it. But, you know, a lot of the concepts are very common sense, and that's the thing that's kind of been missing from a lot of kind of arguments these days is, you know, just the common sense. The other thing that's important is to always get back to the point of looking back and seeing, does this stuff actually work? And that's the whole problem that I have with the way that we treat obesity, is that we fail. Like doctors, they try to help people lose weight because most doctors, almost all doctors, are conscientious and want to help people. And they tell them, you know, to eat a little bit less and exercise a little bit more. So we've given this advice to people, and nobody loses weight, not even the doctor, right? There's plenty of doctors who could stand to lose a little bit of weight. And so that's one of the things that I really thought was a real paradox, right? You have these physicians, who many of whom I know, and they're great people. They're smart, they're very hardworking, and they're not lazy people. Right, to get to that position, you can't be a lazy person. So, but they're very overweight. So the question is, if these people, these doctors, are experts, and it's not a genetic problem as we talked about, then there's only two possibilities: either the person is, you know, a glutton or a sloth, or the advice that we give to eat less and move more is simply incorrect. And this is the thing. I think that that advice to count your calories, to eat less and move more, is not very good advice. But what we've done as a society is instead we've tended to blame the victim. That is, we point the finger at these people who are overweight, and we say, our advice is good, but you're not following it. And it's so unfair, because I don't think the advice is good at all. I think it's very bad advice, and that's why I wrote the book. But it's really a matter of this game that we play, which is blame the victim, right? These people who are suffering, who are victimized by it, they're the ones we blame. We say, it's your fault. You're the one who didn't follow my advice. But the advice was actually bad in the first place, and that's really the most kind of unfair thing about it. Because if you look at a show such as The Biggest Loser, for example, and you see these people who are so desperate to lose weight, they're exercising for hours and they're eating very little and so on. And it's like, you're telling me that these people have no willpower? Like, what, are you crazy? Like, look at them. They have all the willpower in the world, but if you give the wrong advice, there's nothing you can do. It's kind of like if you're trying to go from Toronto to Florida, and you head west or you head north.
Well, that means you're visiting me.
Exactly. It doesn't matter how hard you run. You're still not going to get there because you've gone in the wrong direction. It's the same thing if you take bad advice. It doesn't matter how hard you follow it. You're not going to succeed. So this whole calorie idea is just really wrong, but it makes it so unfair because then the people are being blamed unnecessarily, and this is what happens. If you look at the statistics, for example, somewhere along the line of 50% of Americans have prediabetes or diabetes, and a slightly higher proportion are overweight or obese. So think about this for a second. If you have a teacher with 30 students or 40 students, and one of those students fails, you can say, yes, that's the student's fault. But now you have a situation where 25 out of 30 kids are failing. Well, I think that's the teacher's fault, right? And that's the thing. We never blame the authorities for telling us this wrong information.
They believe it. So it's not like they're lying. It's that they too are misinformed.
Yeah, they too are misinformed. They're not malicious. They're not trying to do it, but they're so sure that they're correct, and they don't have an open mind about some of these other ideas about obesity that really is not about calories. You don't really want to be eating all the time. Look at some of these other changes that people can make to get better. But instead, all we get is, count your calories, let's put calorie labels on fast food and so on, as if that's really the issue. So that's the thing, is I think that and there's always a big debate when the dietary guidelines comes out, what should be there, what should not be there.
Now, as a doctor, within your practice, things that you're saying are not the hard potty line for Health Canada, but is that okay within your position, since your view is different?
Yeah, I mean, there's no problem with telling people this stuff, because really it's just a matter of trying to make them better, right? So nobody enforces the Health Canada guidelines, for example, but the issue I have is that they're spending a lot of money on education, but if you're educating the wrong thing, that's not helpful.
Okay, so you can work your way up into being the head of that department. You have my vote. But let's talk about the wonderful system that you have laid out, which I imagine you have seen work in patients in your book, The Obesity Code, so people can start understanding what the program that you see is that actually does work. And I know it does. It does involve some avoidance, like let's talk about sugar, for instance, because that's something everyone pretty much agrees on.
Yeah, so the thing is that if you look at what the body is doing, so when you take calories or expend calories, the problem is not too many calories. The problem is that you're using it to store away as fat, right? So if you take in the calorie of energy, you can either store it as fat or you can burn it for energy, right? Obviously, we want to burn it as energy. But the problem is that we store it as fat. So that's what happens. So it's not a problem of total energy coming in. It's a problem of what the body is doing with it. So again, the insulin is what's telling our body to store that as fat. And that's the real problem. So if you understand that, then it's very simple to understand that what we need to do is lower the insulin. And the question is how to do that. And of course, one of the first things you can see is that foods that stimulate a lot of insulin, you should cut those down. So the most obvious are the refined grains and the sugars. So they don't really have any kind of essential nutrients, so it's easy to cut them back. And I think we've done that to a large extent. So cutting sugar is obviously one of the first things we've done.
Well, that's probably something that actually is agreed to by most of the medical profession.
In fact, the what to eat sort of question is mostly agreed upon. So cutting a lot of the refined grains, for example, the breads, the pastas, the muffins, the donuts, all that sort of thing, most people kind of understand if you eat too much of that starchy food, you're going to gain weight. So that's kind of understandable. Then you look at fat, and we have to say, well, you really have to not be so concerned about the dietary fats, because we've been very kind of fat phobic for many years, and the thing is that there's a lot of fats that are very healthy for you. So we actually tell people to don't just try and cut back, but what you want to do is try and introduce more of these healthy fats, what we call natural fats, so fats that exist in nature, so things like avocados and olive oil and nuts and so on. But even things like butter and meats with saturated fat. Saturated fat for many, many years we are told that is very, very bad for the heart, causes heart attacks, but the evidence to support that is actually non-existent. So there's really no evidence. And it's hard to imagine that people have been eating saturated fats in the form of beef, for example, and butter for kind of millennia. And for 4,000 years, it's fine. And since 1977, it's bad for you, right? It's like that doesn't really make a lot of sense. These are natural foods, right? When you start to get into problems, when you start to process the foods, when you start to introduce chemicals, when you start to change the foods, right? When you hydrogenate oils and all this kind of stuff, that's when you start to really see a lot of problems, is when you're eating these sort of fake foods. But if you stick with whole natural foods, you almost can't go wrong. So that sort of question of what to eat is fairly, you know, most people agree on that. But the other thing that you need to do is look at your meal timing.
No, but I want to go back a little bit to sugar.
Sure.
Since that's something. Now, what about, let's say, you know, sugar, obviously you're talking about it being an issue, but what about all the sugar substitutes that are proliferated, especially with the weight loss diets?
Yeah, those
should be cut out. Which is artificial sweeteners that trick the body, but I think does not even lead to the shutdown of the response, a hunger response.
Exactly, and this is the thing. If you look from a common sense standpoint, if it was all about calories, if it was all about replacing sugar with artificial sweeteners, guess what? We wouldn't have an obesity problem because we've been using aspartame since the 70s, and it's not like people don't know about it. It's everywhere. And guess what? It doesn't make any difference, right? So whether you take artificial sweeteners or not, most people have noticed no difference. Like, when was the last time you heard somebody say, you know what, I switched from sugar to, you know, from Coke to Diet Coke, and I just lost like 50 pounds. Right?
Oh, never. In fact, it seems to have the opposite effect.
It does. It seems to have the opposite effect. Because, again, it's not the sugar. It's not the calories, right? Because you know that Diet Coke is zero calories. It's not the calories. That's the wrong issue. It's looking at the insulin response. And the insulin response to these sweet foods is just as high. So that's the thing. If insulin is now you're taking a Diet Coke, your insulin spikes up, your body gets the instruction, oh, you need to store energy. Right? Because that's what you're telling your body by drinking that Diet Coke, which spikes up your insulin. Well, it needs to go get energy. So it makes you hungry. It makes you want to eat. So that's what exactly what happens, right? Is that you drink the Coke, your insulin goes up, your body wants to store energy, but it's got zero calories coming in, so you go and find something else to eat. And that's why people can't lose weight drinking Diet Coke. So we tell them, no, the Diet Coke and the regular Coke, they're exactly the same. Nobody loses weight with diet drinks. If it did, you know, guess what? We'd be already out of the woods here. But it's not, so we tell them not to do it. And the other issue about sugar is that people think of it as empty calories, but it's not. It's actually something that fattens you, right? And it's because of the fructose. And it's the same issue with high fructose corn syrup. Because most carbohydrates, so bread, for example, or flour, is chains of glucose. sugar, which is sucrose, is a combination of glucose and fructose, so it's 50% fructose. And the issue with fructose is that your body can't really use it. So it all goes right into the liver and gets metabolized by the liver. It causes fatty liver, which causes insulin resistance, which in the long term shoots up your insulin levels. Because your body is resistant to insulin, it has to produce more insulin in order
to
overcome
that. Doesn't get into the cell. Well,
yeah.
We have to take one more short break here, Dr. Fung. And when we come back, I would really like you to explain to our listeners your program in a capsule. They can always get your excellent and easy-to-read and well-documented and referenced book. So that's a very important thing to do. And also, why you or how people can sort of immediately put intermittent fasting into their life. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Progressive Radio Network, the number one network for those who care about the truth.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Michael Wald, and I'm proud to announce that I'm the host of a new show right here on PRN every Saturday at 1 o'clock entitled Ask the Blood Detective. And as your friendly neighborhood blood detective, I'll be exploring all the cutting-edge, important health topics, which will include everything from foods to technology to supplementation and how it impacts your current health so that you can either reach health, maintain good health, or shoot for optimal health and longevity. But what is different about this show is that I'll be describing and teaching you how to interpret your own laboratory tests to find hidden nutritional and health meaning when many other healthcare providers fail to do so. So tune in with me every Saturday at 1 o'clock. Ask the Blood Detective. See you soon.
Hi, I'm David Crowe, host of The Infectious Myth that airs at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN. I use data to deconstruct the myths that infect the modern world. Myths within health and medicine, other areas of science, the justice system, society, media, censorship, and politics. Join me for challenging interviews and discussions. Listen live, as a podcast, or by dialing 701-719-0990. Thanks for listening.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we have been talking to a brilliant young physician and researcher who really has put forth a volume that you want. It could have been called so many other things besides the obesity code, but it's not just a, you know, come on board weight loss book. It has to do with overall health and wellness and what's really fueling not only the obesity diabetic, but the problem with insulin resistance as well as his specialty being a nephrologist in kidney disease, which really links right back into this, as well as diabetes and so many other health issues. So it's really an impressive piece of work. And thank you for being our guest today, Dr. Jason Fung.
Oh, thanks very much.
So I would like you, because we're getting towards the end of the show already, lay out the program that people would be able to find all the details about in the obesity code.
Right. So, you know, we talked a bit about the kind of what to eat, you know, avoiding the sugars, avoiding grains, which is not that controversial, really. And most people have really heard about that. But what understanding the real process of what causes people to gain weight allows us to introduce something else that most people haven't tried, which is intermittent fasting. And fasting, of course, is just a period of time that you're not eating. And the thing is that if you don't eat, you'll lose weight. If you don't eat, you're going to allow your body to burn off some of that fat, which really is just stored food energy, right? And that's the reason that we keep it there, is because we have it for us to use when we don't have food, right? That's the whole point of it. So burning it off by not eating is absolutely natural. This is what it's designed to do. There's nothing wrong with it. And there's so many sort of fasting myths and so on. I'll just say that after the obesity code, I do touch on fasting at the end of the book, but then I wrote actually a second book called The Complete Guide to Fasting, which answers the questions much more specifically, because there's a lot of kind of myths and misperceptions out there.
Well, so we'll have you back on in the future to discuss that one. But when you say fasting, it's not like you have to stay home from work for a week and starve yourself.
No, absolutely not. So fasting is completely flexible. So you can fast for 12 hours, you can fast for 16 hours, 24 hours, 36 hours, or a week, or even longer. Some people fast for a month, and we've had people do that. Now, we do that under supervision.
That you want to go home and do that on your own. Right.
Absolutely. But the shorter ones, like 24 hours, like, people worry so much about what will happen if you don't eat for 24 hours. And I say, guess what? Nothing happens. Your body fuels itself from the food that you've stored away. That's the whole point of it, right? So people fast for all kinds of reasons, but if you're doing it for weight loss, for example, people worry that they're going to go into so-called starvation mode, that their metabolism will drop to such an extent that they're not going to be able to lose weight. And that's a complete myth. If you look at the studies, for example, about the basal metabolic rate, that's the number of calories that you burn in a 24-hour period. And what's interesting is that if you try and cut calories, if you just try to go from 2,000 calories to 1,500, pretty soon your body will reduce its caloric expenditure down to 1,500, which means you're going into starvation mode. But what happens when you eat zero is that your body can't go to zero. So what it does is it switches fuel sources from your food to your fat. So now you're just burning the stored food energy. And that's perfect. That's exactly what we wanted to do. And
well,
the other
you're
thing
talking
we say,
about even a 12-hour fast being useful. How about, like, don't eat after dinner till the next day? Is that a big stretch?
Absolutely. That's what we used to do. And so the very term breakfast is the meal that breaks your fast. What it means is that you have to fast every day. It's just a part of everyday life, right? You want to balance your feeding and your fasting, so you have to fast every day. We've lost that, right? We go the minute you get up, you eat, and the minute you go right to the minute you go to bed. So there's no more fasting. It's all feeding, and then we wonder, why are we gaining weight? Well, you haven't allowed yourself the time to burn that energy. And if you want to lose weight, then that probably isn't enough. You may need to extend the time that your body is using that stored energy. So what you may do, for example, is go to 16 hours. So 16 hours of fasting every day and 8 hours of eating. So you might eat, for example, between 11 in the morning and, you know, 7 at night, or, you know, 9 to, 3, something like that. So that the period of time that you're eating is compressed, and some people call it a compressed time window for eating, or some people call it 16-8 because it's 16 hours of fasting and 8 hours of eating. The shorter fast, of course, you do more frequently, so that might be done kind of 6 days out of 7 or so on. If you go to a 24-hour fast, for example, that means going from dinner to dinner. So you might eat dinner on Monday, and then you skip breakfast, skip lunch. You drink fluids, waters, teas, coffee, whatever you want, and you go until dinner the next day. And that's a 24-hour fast. So being a little bit longer, you might do that 2 to 3 times a week. And the thing is that during that period, you should do everything that you normally do. There's nothing special, because really what you're doing, what you have to imagine, is that you're basically letting your body eat your own fat. So if you've eaten lunch of your own fat, then hey, you can do everything normally. Why do you have to skip your exercise or not work or stay home? And I do this all the time. You just work, and your body will take care of the rest. It's the your body is like such a wonderful, you know, piece of machinery, but we'd never give it any credit, right? We think we have to micromanage it. It's kind of like we have Michael Jordan on our team, and we're kind of trying to micromanage him as to what to do. It's like our body is wonderful. If you don't eat, it'll figure everything out for you. So that's the thing. If you can even extend it longer if you want. So now as you get into longer fasting periods, there is a little bit more risk. You know, there's a bit more problem with hunger. Hunger is probably the main thing people get worried about. And you have to understand a couple things. First of all, that the first couple weeks that you do intermittent fasting, it's going to suck. That's what we tell people. It's going to suck. Just get over that, right? Because it's like exercise. If you run a marathon, the very first time you go running, your muscles are going to be sore. You're going to feel terrible. You don't say, well, running is really bad for you, right? It's the same with fasting. The first few times you do it, it's probably going to be a little bit difficult. Hunger is the main issue, but hunger comes in waves. So when it passes, you kind of forget about it. So think back to a time where you were so busy that you kind of worked right through lunch. At 12 o'clock, you're probably hungry, but you're so busy, you just kind of went on. By 2 o'clock, it felt like nothing. Why? Because your body has pulled all that food energy out from your stores, from your fat, and burned it for lunch.
And it also does matter, and you do have recommendations in the book, what you eat. It's not like you can just exist on fast food, and it actually gets easier when you have more nutrition from choosing healthier foods. Well,
yeah.
Unfortunately, we are at the end of our time, Dr. Jason Fung, and your wonderful book, The Obesity Code. We will have links to your information on the archives. The show will be archived, and I'll send you a link, Dr. Fung, as well, that you could feel free to embed or download. And I'm also going to email you to pick dates for the future, because I'd love to continue this conversation with other radio audiences, as well as take a look at your newer book when it's available as well. So thank you so much for being our guest today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again. We love to hear from you. Get in touch at The Natural Nurse or naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.